Thank you for listening to Dental Marketing Theory. I'm your host, Gary Bird. Today we have Genevieve Poppy. She did a wonderful job in really explaining and breaking down a lot of her journey and how she got into the dental industry. She also shared some of the myths and stories that we tell ourselves as we move from a private practice to a group practice. She also dove into imposter syndrome in dentistry and how to tackle that. And also, we covered some topics around why your org chart might be working against you. Genevieve heads up Poppy Practice Management and really honestly has probably forgotten more about dentistry than most people know. So I'm really looking forward to sharing this episode with you, and I hope you enjoy it. It would really help us out also if you just give us a quick thumbs up and you share this podcast. Have a great day. Genevieve, good to see you. How are you doing today?
I am doing great. Thanks for having me this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. We're excited to talk through your story and about what you do and how you make such an impact on the dental industry. So you had a birthday recently, right?
I did. Yes.
Have a happy birthday.
Older than I care to admit.
So I was reading online. So I saw something online that you're grandparents used to call you and sing happy birthday to you.
Yes.
Yeah, that's special. So I had a funny story that actually reminded me about something. So my mom, when I got older, moved out, my mom would always make me a cake when I was younger. So she would mail me a cake.
Aww.
As I was 18, 19, 20. And so I'd get this cake. It was all smashed up. Candles were mixed in. It was not editable. But so I didn't tell her forever though. So I got those cakes for a long time, but it made me think about that on your birthday.
Oh, I love that. It's very sweet. Those are the things that stick with us a long time and then cause us to create our own little traditions for our families and kids.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I also saw that you went to Wrigley Field recently. How was that experience? Was that your first time?
That was my first time at Wrigley as a Brewers fan. It was particularly, being a Brewers fan is a loaded thing, right? I mean, we mostly go to drink outside and eat hot dogs, but it was fun to watch the Brewers really beat up the Cubs. Cubs fans are notoriously a pain when they come to Milwaukee, so I enjoyed it.
Oh, so you were in Milwaukee, so, or were you in Chicago?
No, I was in Chicago. So normally, okay, when Cubs fans come to Milwaukee, they're not the nicest guests.
They're not nice to you guys?
No.
Wow.
It's not a very nice rivalry. You're right. Yeah, Chicago, Milwaukee. But it was really fun, actually. I went with a friend, client of mine, and he was very gracious. And it was felt good to be out in a big crowded space and pay $20 for nachos again.
That's awesome. Yeah, $20 nachos are the best.
They are.
That's great. I wanted to kind of dive into your story. I think you have a pretty unique dental story. Starting out, I can relate a little bit to your story. I also was a naughty teen growing up, and that kind of forced me in a certain direction. And I found it fascinating how some of your decisions kind of pushed you into the dental industry and then where that led you and what you learned from that. So would you mind kind of starting at the beginning of that and working through that?
Yeah. The beginning of my dental story starts literally when I was in high school. I had a guidance counselor that was desperate to find me a job for work study because she could hardly keep me attending school. I was a school skipper, partially because, and I still graduated early. School was just easy. I was bored and was naughty. And so I got a job at Dr. Smith's office, literally Dr. Smith. And I started with just the very basics in the office. I did recare postcards and was a hygiene assistant and perio-charted with red and blue pencil for those of us old enough to remember doing that. And at the time, I thought I might go into being a dental hygienist. But because I was a naughty teen, I wound up graduating high school pregnant. And it forced me into a little bit different direction. I wound up dental assisting and then realizing that I really loved that. And then making my way into office management. And ultimately, from there, realizing I was pretty good at growing a dental office and that I should maybe try to do it for myself, I left my dental world briefly to work in private equity and then got the idea that I could maybe create a fund or use that path to create a path where I was an owner of dental offices. Mm-hmm. And so I do think my path in dentistry is a little unique in that way. There are certainly more non-dentist owners now than there used to be. but I really learned a lot, and it's really positioned me in the consulting world to have a very gritty, practical relatability.
I love at the beginning of your story how you said you loved that you were able to miss school so you could go work, and that was something that really motivated you. But then obviously that grew into something, right? You started to enjoy it. So what was it about dentistry that drew you at the beginning stages?
You know, at the very beginning stage, I thought, this is a great job. It's no nights, no weekends, or at least that's how it was in the 90s. And yeah, it's changed a little bit.
You used to be very, very banker hours, right?
Right. And I thought it would be something that I could feel I was very professional. Like it felt like a very professional thing to do to me. And that mattered a lot to me at the time, you know, that I could elevate myself out of the way. I'd always been perceived as like this poor kid. I was kind of like the friend that nobody wanted their kids to hang out with, you know? So like the idea that I could have this like respectable professional life and wear white pants, like that kind of initially appealed to me. I looked fancy, but then I just really found, especially as I got into dental assisting, I found that I really appreciated helping people feel fixed up again. I had terrible teeth as a kid. I only went to the dentist when things hurt. You know, I had stainless steel crowns on my molars, even into my adulthood, that I didn't get fixed until I was in dentistry. And so understanding the confidence that that could bring back to people very personally, mm-hmm. and the way that you could help people, not just like with the aesthetics of it, but with the feeling like you've taken care of yourself or that you figured out how to afford it. Those types of things really mattered to me on a very personal level, and I could still geek out about them. I know most people in dentistry still care about that, but I think we've gotten to be in kind of a different place with dentistry, and our own insurance focus forgets some of that personal element that's still there for people.
Absolutely. Yeah. It really does make a big difference in people's lives. So that's what drew you in. And then you became a dental assistant, because I know a lot of people are going through this right now. What was that point where you said, okay, I'm a dental assistant, but I want to make this transition into more of the business side and less of the clinical side? When did that light go off and how did that happen?
For me, it was almost accidental. I followed a doctor that I had worked with when he was an associate into his own practice. And this experience shaped a lot of my future path in dentistry, but he, like many doctors, acquired the team with the practice. It was a very dysfunctional team with some nice people that had been poorly managed for a really long time. And one not so nice person that happened to be his front office person. And there was a lot of stress and tension with keeping her on, and ultimately the doctor let her go. And I just sort of had to figure it out up front. Like it was just kind of me and him. And it turned out that because I understood his dentistry and I had assisted him, I was actually much more valuable to him on the front end of the patient experience. I could close treatment. I could bring in new patients. I could manage his schedule in a way that previously hadn't been able to happen for him. And so I really just sort of fell in love with running that part of the day in that part of the patient experience. Mm-hmm. And then kind of, I guess, in my own entrepreneurial way, brought that to his practice even back then, just sort of took charge of it and made it my own.
Got it. So it was really just creating those opportunities. You created opportunities for somebody else and they noticed it and you slotted in more to the business side, which makes total sense. And then at what point did you go from that, hey, I'm helping somebody, I'm more in the business side, I'm less in the clinical, to I can do this. I can be the entrepreneur now. And you were kind of like, sounded like you were an entrepreneur there for a bit.
Right.
What happened there and how did you move through that transition?
You know, it's funny because this doctor, while I'm grateful to him for so many parts of my career and my work ethic and the things I believe about dentistry, make no mistake, he was a difficult doctor to work for. Very, very difficult. Kind of an old school, I'm the doctor, authoritarian type of management. And honestly, I just felt like so many days I saved him from himself, right? I saved him from bad interactions with patients. I saved him from bad choices. And I really realized how much of his success was the direct result of my hustle and my work for him and my sacrifice for his practice. And honestly, it started with saying things with some of my coworkers, like, this place would be so much better if I owned it and I could hire a dentist. Like, that was like the early idea. And then I wound up just not seeing that I could really do that. I came from basically a dental assisting salary, but I realized I couldn't work for this kind of toxic person forever and continue to throw myself under the bus for him every day for no real ultimate gain. And I took a job outside of dentistry. I went and worked in as an office manager in a small private equity firm, which was a huge departure for me. But I did it because I actually was so loyal to this office that I built up that I felt sick at going to work at another office. Like I just felt like I couldn't even do it. But then as I was working with this very small private equity group, I went to Chipotle for lunch with my boss at the time.
I love Chipotle.
I feel like only good things can happen over a Chipotle burrito bowl.
Yes. I love their process too. I love the way that they kind of mastered that process and made things quick.
I love everything about Chipotle. Everything they do is beautifully executed. But we were kind of talking about like what I see as the pain points. And I started telling the story of watching the doctor I'd worked for acquire this practice and all the things that I perceived as flawed about that and all the things he didn't know. And we kind of just launched the idea of a small fund where we could ease the transition process in private practice dentistry and create an affiliate group. So this was sort of early DSO days, and I didn't really want to be corporate. That was kind of yucky.
Yeah.
At the time, at least in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's what I was taught as well. I was taught, because I only worked with single practices, and everybody, every consultant, every dentist that I ever talked to said, DSOs are the devil, and that's like the worst thing in the world.
Right. Bad dentistry. Only bad dentistry happens there, and only good dentistry happens. And yeah, that was the story, right? And so we created at the time what would be an affiliate model where we had our individual locations be able to have a majority ownership earn out in their location, but still hold at this parent level.
Real quick, before you dive into that, so when did that, I'm interested in when that transition happened in your brain that that's not the truth, right? About DSOs. There's good DSOs and bad DSOs. There are good single practitioners. There's bad single practitioners. There's good office managers. There's bad office managers. When did that transition in your brain happen? Was it during this process?
Yeah, it really was. And probably backwards of how you might think. The more private practices for sale that I evaluated to purchase, and the more of them I went through, the more I realized a private practice does not equal great dentistry. It's not a guaranteed correlation. And so, you know, if that could be true, then it could be true the other way. And then as we started hiring in young dentists that had come from these corporate backgrounds, I realized many of them were great dentists. And so it was very firsthand that I realized that the quality of dentistry doesn't correlate to the corporate structure that you operate under. Now, there might be pros and cons of private practice versus DSOs.
Sure.
Obviously, that we could talk about those all day. But, you know, anytime somebody wants to get uppity about corporate practice to me, I'm like, well, you know, I've had the unique experience of seeing a lot of dentistry firsthand. And I'm not a dentist, but I can tell you based on redos and fall apart rates and my own eyes, I was an assistant for a long time. I have learned a lot about dentistry that there are a lot of really nice guys practicing really bad dentistry in private practice. a lot of really good guys practicing really good dentistry. You can be good or bad. It doesn't really have to do with that setup.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, so now you're part of an affiliate, you called it. It wasn't exactly a DSO yet.
Right. It was an affiliate group. We had a parent company that initially sort of wholly owned these private practices. And then there was, I guess, what would be essentially sort of a management earnout set up for majority ownership of each of the dentists. So just the idea was to give more of a private practice autonomy type feel for each of these young doctors, born in the best of intentions, wrought with tons of issues.
So you had 7 practices?
We did, yeah.
And then what was your role there? What was your title or job, or were you kind of wearing a bunch of hats?
I was, initially co-founder, director of operations. My partner had no dental operational background. So initially, he was a private equity guy. He could raise a fund and keep a cap table and model stuff. And I don't want to take away from those skills, but it had very little to do with getting a dental office actually transitioned and up and running. And so for a long time, really the first 4, I was the only operational person, really, which was a lot. I did all of the marketing. I did all of the management, all of the hiring, all of the firing, everything. I worked basically all the time. That's what I did. And then I did bring in a second person to help me a little bit as I focused more on recruiting and acquisition, and learned a lot of painful lessons in that process.
Yeah, let's talk through that. So what did you learn through that process of being there? And now you've gone through the gamut and you literally started as an intern, so to speak, and worked all the way up to actually owning practices. What were some of the lessons on the owning practice side, and what kind of drove you out of that and moved you into consulting?
Yeah, well, one of the first things I learned was that my initial theory and idea, and it sounds so naive when I say it now, it's hard for me to not laugh, is that I thought, truly, I was young, pure, I just thought, this is going to be so awesome. We're going to create an opportunity for young dentists to go from A to B faster than they could ever get there on their own with so much support. I know exactly what to do. I'll tell them exactly what to do. They'll be grateful for that, and then we'll all be successful.
And that didn't work?
No. My input was not always received with such gratitude. And often when you are in the position of being both the person who has fiduciary responsibility for investor money and the pressure of performance of these businesses, and you're the one with the know-how who has to give the direction and the feedback, I was in a position of having a lot of hard conversations, and I was ill-equipped to do so. I didn't have a background that set me up for being super successful with those things. Mm-hmm. And then the other side of it is, unfortunately, I had a partner who would privately prop me up to go have those hard conversations, and then after the fact, when they didn't go great, would completely undermine me.
Yeah.
And it was really toxic, and it went on that way for years and ultimately didn't work out, which is why I'm not doing that anymore. It was not a very healthy partnership on that level.
So how did you break that? I mean, it's not easy just to leave something that you own. How did you end up breaking that relationship and getting into starting your own consulting firm?
At the end of the day, I was basically voted off my own island. It was really, really painful. It was honestly one of the single most traumatic experiences of my adult life. I was really devastated. I put years and years of my life on the line to build that whole thing. In the end, to feel somewhat betrayed by somebody I thought was my partner and my friend, but also just to realize that all of the people I had trained up and brought on and lost sleep over their well-being, when you're gone, very few of them really care. So it's a lesson to be careful and to be cautious about how much of your own value or worth you put into your job, which for me was almost all of it. It was a hard realization.
So it's a rough transition, right? And obviously very impactful. And I've been there as well, where you're dumping your life into something and that something blows up and it's like, well, then who am I and what am I doing, right?
Correct.
And so what were something good that actually came out of that for you then? Was there any positives that you were able to draw out of it?
The positive for me, I guess, was in the making it through. So when I left it, my confidence was definitely rocked. I felt like I wasn't even sure if I could be a consultant. I started doing some just phone skills coaching, and I wasn't even sure I was qualified to do that. You know, I was in a very low place confidence-wise. But as soon as I got to interacting with other offices and I saw that there were people who were grateful for my insight and were happy for my help and that I could make big differences in their office and small moves, it was really reaffirming that this thing that I cared about and loved so much wasn't gone for me. You know, it wasn't over. I didn't totally lose it. And in fact, it gave me a new path to do it in a way that's actually much more rewarding for me.
That's awesome. And I've heard you speak about this before, and I think this is prevalent in the dental industry, is that imposter syndrome of, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm not supposed to be helping these people. I'm not qualified. Even though you might be the most qualified in that particular subject, it tends to creep in. So you were able to overcome that through this process?
It took a minute. It did, for sure. But I feel like I did overcome it, though I'll be honest, I think all of us still have those moments. You know, I'm going off to ADOM to speak this week. And every time I prepare a talk, I think, what if I say this whole thing and then everybody in the audience is like, duh. Yeah, you know, like...
That makes me feel good because I literally go through that process myself. I'm like, I'm going to say something so stupid that everybody's going to look at me and go, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. So
right. Yes.
I think a lot of people deal with that. In fact, what I was told, someone once told me that if you're walking up and you just are like, I'm going to kill it, I'm the best at this, there's probably something off there, right? Like there should be some nervousness as you walk through to either speak or do something big that's pushing you out of your comfort zone.
I hope that's true. I know people who don't seem to be shaken at all, but I think that's the thing is we all think that nobody else is shaken because we look at them and we think they're so good. They're the person everybody looks to for this. And what's strange or what I understand about that imposter syndrome is that it's like it only gets worse. The more successful you become, the worse you feel that you shouldn't be there or don't deserve it. I carry with me this, it still creeps in. The doctor whose practice I built before I moved on, and I mean, I literally built it on my back, told me one time that I could have really been something if I had gone to college.
Wow.
And so I was insecure about that for a really long time, especially even as I owned practices, I would have young dentists say things to my partner like, well, she's just a dental assistant. And so I let that stuff really, really bother me. And then one day I realized, you know, I'm just a dental assistant who's owned more practices than you. And I'm just a dental assistant, I mean, this is to be cocky, who knows how to take something that's on fire and pull it back together and get it thriving in a short amount of time. And so while I'm just a dental assistant, I'm just a dental assistant who knows how to do a lot of stuff that you don't know how to do.
That's awesome. And so now what you focus on is in... The cool part about this story to me, as I was listening through this and as we pieced it together, is that you now are helping other people build their dental empires, right? So you're coming in and you're saying, no, don't go left, go right. And you kind of had to go through all that stuff to get there, right? Like if you didn't go through all that, you wouldn't be able to have all these different ideas about private equity. And so that's the cool part for me as you begin to work through that. So now you're in the, I'm going to help others build their empire. What is that like? Where are you at now? What are you doing now? And how is it going?
Well, there are a lot of questions. It's going really well. I really enjoy what I've always believed is, and the reason I built this affiliate model instead of a DSO at the time, which this has its challenges. I don't necessarily recommend this, is that I just always believed there isn't one exact way to run a dental practice. You know, there isn't one exact set of rules that work for every set of patients, for every set of clinicians. And helping people figure out with some clarity. And that was hard for me because I wanted to create an environment where there's autonomy. And yet then I really struggled to manage it because people wanted to do what they wanted to do. And I promised them that. And it was wrought with problems of communication and a lack of clarity. And so helping people, especially in that early phase of building their empire, is really fun for me to help them get tough and clear around what they really want to do, what really does matter to them, what has to be their way and what doesn't, and then how to communicate and build something around that without fear and with really openly and really brave in their candor. Like that is really, really fun. It's almost like it feels like I can have this moment to spare somebody a painful path that I had to endure.
Yeah, that's great. And then you were consulting in the middle of COVID, is that right?
Mm-hmm, correct.
So what was something good that came out of COVID for you business-wise?
A couple of good things came out for me. One, I realized that I have some depths of relationships with my clients that are really valuable, that we supported each other through a tough time, and that maybe means more to me than it should from a healthy consulting standpoint. But after my failed partnership, when I felt like I left it without a lot of value, it's those things matter to me. But also I had been traveling just a lot. I mean, I was gone all the time. And so realizing that I could still have effectiveness in shifting more of my coaching to virtual, less travel.
Just to be clear, you were traveling for work a lot.
A lot.
So COVID caused you to go a little bit more virtual?
Yeah. which has just given me back some balance. So I still travel because I like to, and I like to spend time with people in person. That's important to me. I just enjoy it, and I think I get something a little different out of it. But I don't have to do every interaction and every visit, you know, every session in person. And so I've lost some status with the airlines, but I've gained some time.
That's the video title clip that we're going to use right there, losing status with airlines. So walk me through that transition, because I had a huge COVID digital communication transition. I'm curious to how that happened for you and what changed. I get it, you're not traveling as much, but what else changed behind that?
What I was hesitant to do, or I think really scared to do, were more of my full day sessions where we would do these strategic full days. I just struggled to imagine that that could be done very effectively via Zoom. And yet I wasn't really reluctant to travel, but my clients were starting to have budgeting issues and, you know, everybody was very scarce and for a moment there. And I just said, well, why don't we try this? And I just made a pivot and I tried to keep going what I could get going. And it wound up being really valuable to my clients. And then I realized, hey, I can do this and actually deliver weirdly an almost more on point session. It stays a little bit more on task and a little bit more concise when you do it that way. I just had to get we had to get our clients a little bit on board with getting their own Zoom setups. And luckily I have an assistant that was really helpful at sort of like front ending that and doing tests with people and things like that. But once I got through the first couple, I started to feel really confident and then really started offering it up as my preferred option. Almost sort of, I don't want to say penalizing, but adding not just travel expense, but a travel fee. Yeah. So that it covered not just my travel, but some of my lost time. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you lose a day there and a day back usually, right?
Exactly.
So what made it better? Why is Zoom better than flying in? And I know sometimes it's better to be in person, but as you were moving through that, what were some of the things that you noticed that improved that experience?
I have found that people are a little bit less likely to waste time on Zoom. So less tangents, less storytelling, which is, I like. It's yeah. Like, want to keep a part of it, but sometimes days go long when you get a bunch of people who are chatty and it feels like we've just got the day and it can go off track. And so strangely, I think people are looking to get to it a little bit more. They're a little bit more focused when they're in a Zoom environment.
That's great. I'm glad you were able to flip that and use that to your advantage and also get more out of it. That is really, really cool. So circling back really quickly, when you started that group, I know a couple really key things came out of that. I know that you learned a lot about Invisalign and impacting your top line, insurance, profitability, phones. What were like the three biggest things that you now look at? And if I was a client and you came to me and you said, hey, Gary, we got to fix these three things. What are those three things that you run to right away that you focus on?
The three things are, and they're so not sexy and they're so not what people want to focus on, are really your new patient conversion, your ability to capitalize from your marketing to new patients, which we can talk about, which just was a huge blind spot for me initially, which are your team's ability to effectively answer a phone, not just answer questions. The second is your ability to sell treatment to those patients, like actually get them to do it.
Actually get them to say yes, right?
Yeah. And the third is how you retain them, which comes down to ReCare, which is mind-bogglingly underserved, you know, where like every office I know puts their automated reminders on and that's their ReCare. And if they really look at it, they're like, well, we have 40 new patients. I'm like, well, if you've had 40 new patients every month for the last 2 months, how many days of hygiene have you added? Well, none.
Yeah.
Okay.
That means you're bleeding somewhere.
Yeah. It's called churn.
Yeah.
you need to look at that. And so those are not like the sexy things, and they're not things that people really want to do or focus on. And they're hard, especially the sales side of it, which comes down to the new patients and the treatment acceptance, because we literally create team members in those seats that are almost the opposite of what you need in those seats.
Okay. So the right people, right seats. Okay. So let's work through those. So new patient conversion, and I'm huge on this, right? Because
I know this is our joint passion.
Yes. Yes. So this is a lot of times, and there's a lot of bad marketing companies out there, and marketing companies have a bad reputation. That's on them.
just like consultants, right?
Just like consultants, same thing, right? And I get why. However, with that said, a lot of dental practices marketing fail because they don't have clarity around conversion. They don't know what Susan's phone conversion is for marketing patients. And it's hard to convert them. It's not easy. If you're just walking in or you just said, oh, I just gave them training one time and there's zero accountability and there's no KPIs, they're not going to convert those. So how do you come in and help people solve that? And then what's the next phase? So everybody knows about the phone and we'll spend a little bit of time on that. But then how do we move into the office and retain those?
Well, the phone call is so critical. And I'll tell you, what we do is we hire people for our front desk who answer the phone. And it's literally the first thing we have them do. I have for real seen people on their first day looking for a card because they're answering the phone, not even knowing like the office address. They're that ill-equipped to be picking up the phone. And what we do is we teach them just pick up the phone and answer questions. They don't even recognize an inquiry as a potential sale. If I ask teams all the time, like, how do you do with new patients? Every single one of them will say, pretty good. Pretty much everybody who calls schedules.
Yep.
Unless they have Medicaid. And I say, so, okay, everybody calls schedules. And what they mean by that is everybody who calls and says, I'd like to schedule an appointment, schedules. But anybody else who says, do you take this insurance or how much is an implant? If I ask them about that, they'll say, well, they just wanted to know if we take this, or they just wanted to know how much this was. And I'm like, no, that's not what they wanted to know.
Wow.
They wanted to know is, can you see me? Can you help me with this?
So when your front desk is telling you, so if there's a doctor listening to this and your front desk tells you, we convert everybody, really they're converting 50%?
No, not even. Probably not even. Honest. And you probably know this. I mean, I commonly see without really any training, it can be as low as 30 to 40%, especially if you are an office that is exiting insurance or not in network with every single person, you're probably in the 30s.
Yeah.
And it starts with, honestly, helping the team members understand that that's a lead. Truly think it registers as a lead to them.
And let me just frame it up this way. So to make it simple, because people like square numbers. So if you're spending $10,000 on marketing and you're at 30% conversion, that means 7,000 of it is lost on the phone. That's just gone. And then to your point, now it's you lost a lead or you didn't convert. The way I look at it is if you're spending $10,000 and you get 100 leads, you're paying $100 to make that phone ring. And I'm just using round numbers.
Yeah.
So each person that doesn't convert is like you're washing a $100 bill down the drain. And your team isn't aware of that. And they're not, I've never met a team without them being coached.
Right.
That understand or look at it that way.
Yeah. And actually, we do a lot of things, and this is my own story with it. We do a lot of things that sabotage them on the phone. Mm. You know, a lot of times what I will hear people, like from a sales standpoint, doing on the phone is terrible, but it's literally what they've been instructed to do. So my own best example of this is I used to have two of my offices were about 3 miles apart in Madison. And Madison, Wisconsin, same basic market, same demographic, same marketing budgets. One was seeing about 45 new patients a month. The other was seeing lucky to see like 12 a month. And I just kept getting, nobody wants to schedule. We're not getting calls, da, da, da. And this was before I had phone tracking. And I had this lucky stroke of fate where I had the office manager and the front office person at the second office out for a couple of days. And I was literally there answering the phones myself. In the first day I was there, I scheduled 8 new patients, which showed me that the phone was ringing quite a bit, actually. But one of them stands out to me to this day because it was a young kid who had said, hey, do you guys require an FMX? That was his first question. And in my head, like I thought, oh, crap. If either of my team members had answered this, they would cite our x-ray policy and say, we do require our new patients to have a current full series of x-rays and da-da-da-da-da-da-da because they're being good policy upholders.
Yep.
But instead, because of the position as I was in, I said, well, you know, we would love for you to have one, but tell me why you ask. Right? And he's like, well, I've been going to Dr. So-and-so down the street, good, reputable doctor, my whole life, and it's his policy that once you turn 23... you have to have an FMX. And I said, oh, well, is there a reason you don't want to have one? And he's like, well, I would. This is how I know he's been had this explained by a dental person. I would, except that I just had a pano and I'm not eligible for an FMX. And I'm like, oh, okay. I said, well, how about this? We would love to have you. Why don't we get you in for cleaning and checkup? We'll get those x-rays sent over here. And if our doctor feels like you need an FMX, it's on me. And he said, are you serious? And I'm like, yeah. I said, otherwise, if you're healthy, we probably won't need it. We'll take it next time you're eligible. He's like, oh, okay, great. We scheduled this cleaning. And then he's like, oh, by the way, do you guys do Invisalign? And I was like, yep, we sure do. He said, well, that's great, because my mom just said she'd pay for my Invisalign. So this doctor down the street lost a call over $100 FMX, and I got a $5,000 Invisalign call just because I simply said, tell me more.
Yep. And you explained it in a way that they would understand, right? Like, yeah. He had no idea what he was talking about. And to your point, just so everybody hears you loud and clear, it's not that you have horrible front desk people. It's that they haven't been trained and they haven't been set up for success. Like, that's the bottom line. And if not, you're going to lose more than half of your new patients on the phone. And it doesn't matter how much marketing you have. So I love that you're passionate around that and you help people around that. And then, so now you come into an office, you've opened up the floodgates now, because now we're actually not telling everybody no, we're telling everybody yes. And so these patients are coming in, but now there's going to be the next bottleneck. And you said it was treatment retention.
Or treatment acceptance or case acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So walk me through what you work through in office on that side.
Honestly, it's very similar to what I talk about with new patients, which is people are really looking for you to help them figure it out. And what we do instead is we seek to give people a bunch of information and I over-educate them and actually overcomplicate the conversation quite a bit. And we're weird about money and we're weird about insurance. And so then we make patients concerned about insurance. And so every office I go to will say, you don't understand. These people want to know exactly what insurance is going to cover. And very seldom have I met a person who actually wants it written in blood that it's going to be $54.60 instead of $60. That is us. We spend an insane amount of time trying to figure to the penny, and then we're wrong. And then our patients are mad because of $17. And so then we're super upset about people being mad that one time. And then we get even more over the top in our desire to protect our AR and make sure they're going to pay. And almost every person that has a case acceptance problem will tell me how good their AR is. It's because they're having money conversations that are so alienating that the people who were just going to do it anyway, they'll do it. But anybody else who needed a little help figuring it out is just not going to do it. And so you'll have great AR, it'll be really low, and you'll also have correspondingly low production and treatment acceptance.
Wow, yeah. And so what I hear there is you're stepping over dollars to pick up pennies a lot of times.
1,000%. Yeah, my whole thing is to really teach them to simplify that conversation and then to get comfortable helping somebody figure out how. So what I see in the way we present treatment typically is like we slide the treatment plan across and we basically say, here's all the information. Let me know if you want to do it, right? We just get it. We're in this if statement. Here's all the information. If you want to do it, you let me know. You don't have to even, sometimes I even say, you don't have to tell me today. That's how conflict averse we are. I really try to teach people to slow down that conversation and make it super simple. And so I give a total to fix you up on the upper right. It's $1,500. Looks like I'm expecting about $800 from your insurance. So I'll have you take care of $700 when you come in. If there's anything left over, I'll settle up with you then. How does that sound? Mm-hmm. Most people say that sounds good and they'll proceed. Other people will say that sounds like a lot. And then I'll say, well, why don't we get you set up on a payment plan with care credit? Or why don't we look at scratch pay or let's figure out what we can do. But they don't even seek to flush out the objection because they don't want it and they're uncomfortable with it. And so it's almost like they're throwing up the hurdle to see if the patient will jump over it. Here's everything your insurance won't do. I know it's a lot. Just let me know when you're ready.
Yeah.
And we actually teach our patients then to care about exactly what insurance is going to cover, because that's all we've talked about.
Yep, 100%. And so again, it just comes down to training. The people who are doing this just haven't been taught how to do it properly and how to really set the patient up for success. Is that, or do you disagree with that?
I think it's training, yes. And I think it's that we just inherently hire the wrong personalities for those seats.
Ah, so that was the next one, was right people, right seats.
We hire the insurance expert right? To have treatment coordinator conversations. And I see this happen all the time. I'm not taking away from insurance knowledge, but frankly, the person that loves doing insurance is very likely not your most successful, extroverted, high-I treatment coordinator. So
let me get this straight. So if you're slaying the insurance dragons every single day and you are battling with them and you love that, you're probably not the people person on the other side that should be presenting those fees. Yeah. And that happens a lot, like, because it's just like, well, you're the insurance person. So really getting clear on the right person for the right seat, for the right job, and moving through that. So do you have a process that you help people go through to determine the right person, right seat?
Yeah, well, we do. And understanding your own org chart or your own structure is way more essential than people think it is. What we do all the time is we get busy and then we hire more people to be busy with us. And so while in this average practice, you might have to start with sort of the jack of all trades, front desk people who know some about people and some about insurance. As you grow, if you could create roles that were more specialized that allowed you to hire the personalities that would be most successful in them and train for the skills that would make you most successful in them, you would find that you could probably have less people who were more overall successful. And yet very few people, while I see people with job descriptions that are 20 pages long and broad, have really thought about the structure and the wise division of roles up front. It usually happens with like, well, this person's been there the longest and she likes to do this and this. And it's dictated very much by one team member who sort of cherry picked their position. And then the others are just doing the other stuff that person doesn't like to do, which is now deemed unimportant. I can't tell you how often I see the most talented, smartest person viewing, picking up the phone or presenting treatment as an interruption to their day. And truly, those are the two most, we should place the highest value on those two tasks at the front desk. And yet we often give those things to the least qualified, lowest experienced people.
Yeah, that's huge. So changing gears on you a little bit here. So what are some of the biggest myths that you're dealing with right now in dental offices?
That people only care about their insurance, I think, is one of the bigger myths in dentistry currently. Kind of going back to what I was saying, I think we care about their insurance and we teach them to care about their insurance. Or that, you know, people only do what their insurance covers. Or every time I look at the amount of treatment we're diagnosing versus what we're putting on the books, what it comes down to is this inherent belief in dentistry that there's this magic set of good patients who will just do all dentistry. And then, and that's who you need to find, marketing person. You're finding bad patients, right? And then all the other people only will do what their insurance covers and only care about insurance and have no money and will spend no money. And that's just simply not true. It's our own ineptitude as an industry to communicate differently about it and help people to proceed with dentistry instead of judging them.
Yeah. So I had to actually learn how to deal with that, right? As a marketing company, because I was told that all the time of like, well, these two patients accepted all their treatment and these 10 didn't, and they were just horrible patients. So I was on a quest of what makes these horrible patients. So what I would do is I would take a very systematic approach to it, is I'd take those bad patients and I'd put them on a map with the good patients. And I'd say, okay, the green patients are good and the red patients are bad or didn't accept all the treatment or didn't accept any treatment. And then I would go in and run incomes of those areas. And then I would do a comparison and I would start to go in and say, well, wait a second, these bad patients live right next door to these really good patients, mm-hmm. and they have more money than the bad patients. And we'd even go sometimes as far as going in and looking at the neighborhoods and, I mean, all of that and really breaking it down so they can actually see, like, this is where this person lives and they didn't accept any treatment. And then we went back and found the call and how they searched for us, and they were in pain and they called and they said, man, I need this taken care of. And they didn't have insurance though, you know, or whatever. They were self-employed and you lost them. And yeah, they're a bad patient. I'm like, no, they went somewhere else and got the work done. Like,
yes,
for sure. Like, for sure. Yes. You offended them so bad somewhere in your process that they're just gone now and they're never going to come back. And you lost all the referral opportunities. It's fascinating to be able to see people's mindset change on that. And I know you go through that and help people with that. it just totally changes. Okay, we need to go in and start fixing some of our processes. And we all have this in business. And I think sometimes people don't want to deal with that. Is like, I don't want to deal with my broken processes. I just had somebody message me this morning and they were like, hey, phones are ringing off the hook. Great job. Onboarding was a little rocky. Here's some of the things that could have improved. And I was just so grateful that they give us the opportunity to learn and get better. And we all have those things in our businesses that we have to deal with. And so I love that. That is a big one there. And I think that that is something that we just have to overcome, because people want dentistry now in America. We've gotten to the place now, and our market saturation is horrible, but people want dentistry and someone's going to do it.
That's the exact thing. I try to tell people, I work with offices all over the country, and I have yet to discover one practice that has an actual legitimate set of these people. That's not a real thing. These people isn't a real thing. And in the number of phone calls I've listened to, which I know you have as well, the number of times I've heard a person call and say, I don't have insurance and I don't care how much it costs because I value your higher education, doctor, because you're so great, just doesn't happen. I mean, I know that's what we hope is will differentiate us to most patients, is like that we have this specialty or our doctor's done this training. And I'm not saying it doesn't bring value to our patients or that they can't come to appreciate it. They will. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Doesn't mean they're going to start off appreciating it or that they have to.
Yeah, 100%. There's three things that a new patient's looking for: proximity, how close are you to my house, social proof, Google reviews, and do other people like you, and the bar of entry and how quickly you can get me in. Is it going to be $500 to get my teeth cleaned, or is it going to be $100 to get my teeth cleaned? And can you get me in today, or is it going to take 3 weeks? That's what new patients care about. And for emergencies, it's like, and you have to get them in within 24 hours, right? You got to get them in right away. So I love that. And I know we're on the same page with that big time. Now, question for you. So I know one of your good friends and somebody that you work with is Josie. And I've worked with Josie for a long time. Love Josie. She was actually on the podcast a couple weeks ago. And can you share a little bit about what you two are doing and what the future kind of holds for you guys?
Yeah. Well, I wish I could share a more formalized announcement, but I can tell you that both Josie and I work together at Traction for Dental as now former EOS implementers. EOS made some changes in going to a franchise model. And I think Josie shared on your podcast that we kind of both elected not to proceed with that. And probably because we are entrepreneurs and struggle at being part of a franchise. But love what bringing an operating system to dentistry has been able to do for both of us as consultants and for obviously for the clientele that we work with. And so we are currently putting our heads together at a revamp of an operating system that is dental industry specific called the Dental Operating System. And if you're in our Facebook group or if you're not, but we have, it's now called the Dental Operating System, and we're really, really excited about it, but it's not quite ready for like full on release yet.
Yeah, it's needed though, right? Like there's really like that for dental that kind of sets the standard of this is what you should be doing in dental, or this is the baseline for dental.
Yeah, I can tell you, I have worked with so many offices that have done so much work into training and consulting and painstakingly writing out systems, and yet they look around their organization and nobody's doing it. They haven't put it on top of an operating system that lets them measure that it's happening, that lets them have eyes on the actual impact and effectiveness of it and help them keep it going and help them make it stick. And so that's why we're so passionate about continuing this path in terms of helping people implement an operating system for their business, just taking it into a little bit more of a dental-specific route for us.
That's great. I'm excited. I cannot wait to learn more. And you guys promise me that you're going to share it with us.
We'll come back on and make a big announcement.
Cool. Right. That's awesome. Okay, great. Also, you're really busy. So you're not only doing that, you're currently helping a bunch of people. You're building a dental operating system, which is huge, right?
Yes.
And then on top of that, you're also a part of the ADMC. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. The ADMC is a group. It's Academy of Dental Management Consultants. We are a group of, you know, vetted, good industry consultants who really work together to help each other be better for our industry. That's what I really love about it. We're a group of consultants that if we don't have the answer, somebody in our group does. And so we're good at referring to each other or helping people find that best resource in our industry. And like you said, there's a lot of marketing companies get painted with a broad stroke. This happens with consultants as well. And I think a lot of that honestly sometimes comes down to not finding the right person you need at the right time when it comes to consulting. And so I'm on the board for that group in terms of managing our sponsoring partners and bringing, you know, vendors into our group that are good fits for our clients. So it's
awesome.
Just another little thing I dabble in.
That's great. Yeah. And when is the next event? I think we're going to that one.
Yes. We are having our conference November 9th and 10th in San Antonio.
That's awesome. Great. Looking forward to it. And then this is totally off base. I'm going 180 degrees the other way now.
Okay.
What is your favorite marketing campaign of all time?
You know, I thought about this a lot because I'm a child who was highly impacted by marketing. I grew up really very poor. And I'm not saying that like I lived in a hut, but I never had the name brand thing ever. I was the one child of the 80s who never had a Cabbage Patch doll. You know, I never got
the name
brand anything. And so I didn't even get name brand cereal. In my grocery store, we had a generic aisle. Like everything was black and white with no, you know, like we just got the cheapest, most generic thing ever. So like every name brand that I perceived as cool or like that people who had money had, I wanted. I think sort of the height of that for me in the 90s was like Calvin Klein ads because like
I remember a teenager
and they were like sexy, but like also kind of cool and preppy and represented some like attainable level of luxury in my head. Mm-hmm. So, plus Marky Mark top shirtless.
I remember that too.
Was, yeah, you know, impactful, I think seared into the brain of a lot of women my age.
Yeah. I remember those ads. Those were during the time of, there was Tommy Hilfiger, there was Calvin Klein, there was like all that group. And you're 100% right. It really, I mean, probably the jeans weren't any different than the ones, the generic ones or whatever at the store.
Probably
but,
not. No.
But yeah, it just having that tag was a big deal.
What it represented. Yes.
Yep. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that with us. So share with everybody here how, if someone wanted to work with you or learn more about you, how could they find you?
Sure. I'm pretty sure I'm the only Genevieve Poppy on Facebook or LinkedIn. Poppy is P-O-P-P-E. I'm fairly easy to find that way. But I have my own, until dental operating system is totally ready to go, you can find me on my own website as Poppy Practice Management.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on. And we can't wait to share this with the world. And I really appreciate you being vulnerable and sharing your story and just helping people.
Awesome. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much for watching today. If you'd like to learn more about SMC or the guests that you listen to, please visit us at smcnational.com.